Now it's time for Believe It.
Believe it. I don't even know if I believe.
Now I'm a believer.
Or not. Believe it or not. On the Jeff Calkins Show.
All right, here's one. Dallas Cowboys should just walk away from Dak Prescott now that they have signed Andy Dalton.
Believe it or not.
This is pitting two of your great quarterback
loves. It's Andy Dalton versus mega Andy Dalton.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I do not believe that. I think in the end, Dak offers you way more than Andy Dalton does in terms of, I mean, you look at the Cowboys offense last year, the Cowboys offense was still pretty explosive, and I understand there will be those that will say, well, if you give Andy Dalton those weapons, we've got 9 years of Andy Dalton. Like, I know what he is. And Dak, I would rather take my chances on.
How many years did it take Jordan to win his first title?
Let's see. So 90, 84, 6.
See the comparison I'm making here? Wasn't it the seventh year?
So he was in the 84 draft, and so maybe that was it.
Yeah, I'm comparing Dalton to Michael Jordan here.
Year 10. Different.
What do you think went into the Andy Dalton's choice? What was he just said, I want to retire and not get hit and be back in the town where I played college football? Obviously, played for TCU and our friend Justin Fuente.
He's from Katy, Texas. I think, honestly, it's kind of an idea of similar to what Jameis is doing, what Teddy Bridgewater did with the Saints, and that the one difference is McCarthy is not Sean Payton, but you go and you're going to be, you know, the backup on a team that has a lot of talent. If you wind up being placed, you know, someone gets hurt, Dak gets hurt, you play, you've positioned yourself to be kind of the next, you know, free agent guy like Teddy Bridgewater. Essentially, you're punting on your own free agency.
Isn't it a little different, though? Jameis is in a position of trying to reclaim his to rebuild his reputation and to learn how to be a quarterback. And he's pretty young still, so he can then go out and use this to springboard into being a starter again, right?
Sure.
Andy Dalton, for all of your criticism,
vitriol, the hate.
He doesn't need to rebuild his reputation, and no one really believes that. Like, there's a better Andy Dalton is what he is.
Sure,
so he should want to find a team that will give him a real chance to be a starter based on what he is, not on this sort of I need to go into quarterback rehab for a year. You know what I mean? And he's also older, so the idea of him going to sit behind Dak, honestly, I think the Patriots weren't interested.
I think twofold. I think the Patriots were not interested, and then I think go look at a place that, we just need an Andy Dalton type. You know, we need that stabilizing. We need that baseline of a quarterback. That team's not really out there, and so if you're Andy Dalton, you didn't have a bunch of good situations, but perhaps, you know, maybe this thing with Dak does stall and it ends up becoming a longer and longer thing, and then all of a sudden now here you are, you could kind of position yourself to backdoor your way into being the starting quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys. Like, I can see where that makes sense. There weren't a bunch of good options, and so he ends up taking the option where at least the guy that's presumed to be the starter is embroiled in a massive contract dispute.
Right. Yeah, I think, and in terms of this, if you are looking to win it, what does Andy Dalton need to do? Win playoff games, right?
Sure.
That's what he needs to do for his career.
Yeah,
a playoff game. Win a playoff game. Multiple would be good.
Yes.
He needs to win playoff games. And you can argue that this is his best chance of winning playoff games. Because if something happens and he becomes the starter, he has a reasonable chance with those weapons around him to win playoff games in a way that if he'd gone to Jacksonville, for example, he wouldn't be winning playoff games. If New England wanted him, he might win a playoff
game. Yes, that would have really helped.
That would have been better. But given that New England apparently didn't want him, I can see the bet that this is the best way for him to win playoff games. But, I mean, Jerry Jones has been clear that they're not walking away from Dak. I don't believe they're walking away from Dak. But he could get hurt, whatever could happen. And so I don't hate it. I don't hate it for the Cowboys. I think it's smart for the Cowboys, honestly.
Yeah, from the Cowboys' perspective,
if you got a backup like Andy Dalton,
yes, and paying him as little as you are, I 100% think this was that's kind of the struggle with the Dallas Cowboys is you want to make fun of Jerry Jones, but
no,
recently
he just keeps doing smart things. I'll be, I think for a long time I took comfort in how stupid he was. No longer. Okay, here's one. University of Memphis fans should be terrified after reading or hearing about Greg Doyle's column in the Indianapolis Star over this weekend.
Believe it or not.
Not after reading the column.
That's the question.
Yes. Not after reading the column. I think most Memphis fans know what they're up against. I think what Greg Doyle's column put into perspective is the unknown about this IARP path. And from Memphis's perspective, it was kind of, you know, the devil that we know never worked out. Every time we tried this enforcement, committee of infractions route, it never worked out for us. Let's try something different. This is something different. I think what Greg Doyle was reinforcing was how little is actually known about that entire process.
Yeah. So Greg Doyle is one of the great columnists in America. And I think he actually did. He won the APSC big. They divide it in circulation categories. Yep. And he was in the big circulation category and was named best sports columnist in America. He's great. He wrote this column saying, be scared. Basically says, be afraid, be very afraid. Right. And it was an interesting column in terms of the procedures and whatever else. It didn't make me any more afraid for Memphis than I was before. The reasons you would be afraid are as follows. One, there's no appeal. Well, we knew there was no appeal, right? Like, maybe for those who didn't know there was no appeal, we knew there was no appeal. So that was one. Secondly, if you hadn't looked at the penalties before, you could look at the penalties and just listening to the penalties. That should, like, the penalties are scary, but they're actually, they now mirror the regular penalties. Like, if they had not been diverted, these are also the available penalties if they hadn't gone to the IARP, okay? Here are the possible penalties. Maximum postseason ban of 5 years. Financial penalties, including loss of all revenue, sharing in postseason competition. Before it was just fines.
Right.
Potential lifetime show cause finding against coaches used to be 10 years is the maximum. Let's be honest. Effectively, 10 years lifetime for Penny Hardaway, who makes it cares? If you got a 10-year show cause, who cares if it's a lifetime, right? He's not coaching anymore, certainly not at Memphis. And double the bans on official and unrecruiting visits up to 100%. Maximum previous loss was 50% of unofficial and recruiting visits. So the bans, the
penalties are stiffer, but they line up more with what was supposed to be the penalty.
They are stiffer.
Ban.
They are now. Those stiffer penalties also apply to the conventional system now.
Right.
So they were stiffened for everybody. Okay. And then the other reason to be afraid, which you probably knew if you were paying attention when we last talked about this, was that you don't present your case if you are Memphis before the body. That they have people who investigate and mm-hmm. people who defend, and they find what they find, and they give you a penalty, and you have to live with it, right?
Yes.
And these are expert investigators.
Yeah.
So, I will tell you this. If I were just idly taking a shot based on nothing, I think Memphis is screwed. Mm-hmm. I suspect that someday in the next year, we will be in here and people will be outraged that Memphis got screwed, quote unquote,
yep.
Screwed by the NCAA. That is my prediction. I think there are likely heavy penalties coming down. It's an obvious case. They played an ineligible player.
Yes.
And furthermore, if they actually investigate and find more than the $11,500, which they might, I don't have any opinion on that one way or another, but then they are further screwed. But the mere fact that they found the $11,500 suggests to me that Memphis wasn't particularly buttoned up about the way they did this, right?
Yes.
If this had been Calipari running the show, they never would have found the $11,500. So, again, I'm not saying Memphis cheats any more than the next guy. Probably less than the next guy if the next guy is John Calipari, right? But do I think they're as smart about it, as careful about it, as buttoned up about it as others have been? Hypothetically, whoever they might be, no. Very clearly not, or they never would have found it to begin with. So is it inconceivable to me that they could find, that this crack body could find something else that Memphis did beyond playing an ineligible player? That's not inconceivable to me at all. So I think Memphis is probably screwed, but not necessarily because of what I read over the weekend. But
yes.
Maybe for those who hadn't read it, it was terrifying to read that stuff over the weekend. And by the way, I also don't rule out the possibility that this body, because it is still, the idea that it's independent is a little crazy. It's yes. appointed by the NCAA. It's independent. They've had training sessions, everything.
This body will know how the NCAA, is more of a rebranding than a remodel.
They're paid and picked by the NCAA. They're not independent of the, this is not, if you want a body that's independent of the NCAA, let them take it to federal court.
Correct.
Let them sue. Literally, there is no right to appeal. There's no right. Well, if you want it, like, the court is independent from the NCAA.
Right.
This is not independent from the NCAA. It's a different enforcement mechanism for the NCAA. It doesn't have current schools serving on it. The NCAA went out and found other people to do their work for them, but it's not independent in any real way. But if you want to make an argument that it is more independent and they might look at this and say, oh, the NCAA shouldn't have changed their mind on James Wiseman, and they did Memphis dirty, I think there's a 10% chance of that happening. But that's not what I would bet on.
Right.
That's not what I would bet on. I don't rule it out. That's my hope. I hope they just say, oh, Memphis has suffered enough, man. Memphis got whacked here, and they've suffered enough, and let's just let them go. Let them be free. I don't think that's what's going to happen. I don't rule it out. But anyway, so it was scary to read it. It was a reminder that there are a lot of unknowns here. But if you were paying attention, you knew Memphis could be in big trouble anyway, right?
Yes. I think you make the case. To me, the reason for why Memphis has chosen the path that it's chosen is we think we have a better chance of obtaining that 10% or whatever. You know what I mean?
Like, I don't even know that Memphis chose it.
Right.
They could have been referred to it. But if you want to be optimistic about
correct.
It, you could say that. Yes.
Yes. You could make that case of we feel as if we have a better chance of getting a fair shot in this room than we do. We know what the Committee of Infractions looks like. We've seen what the recent cases in the Committee of Infractions looks like. Let's take our chance with this.
We know what happens before Memphis in a Committee of Infractions.
Correct.
Memphis gets effed. Right. And so let's take our chances. And that's the hope. But I think it's a pretty slim hope. Okay. You're going to be watching NASCAR for 11 days. 7 races in 11 days. You will be glued to the tube.
Believe it or not.
Probably not. No.
Yeah, not
I mean, I'm a casual NASCAR.
I like the idea, though.
Yeah.
Don't you like the idea?
Oh, I think from their perspective.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
Real sports.
Yes.
It's a real sport. Whatever you like, it is.
Yes.
There's something. There's competition there.
Yes.
7 races in 11 days. They're going to. Obviously, the drivers aren't in any particular danger anyway, right? The drivers are out. They're not. The real issue is the crew.
Crews. Everyone involved.
And they're
in
not
getting the cars. And
they're not. Yeah, and they're going to spread. They're not all going to be jammed together in the garage like they were. They're going to, because there's no fans there, you can spread out of the whole racetrack to do your setup and everything else. They're not going to have qualifying and whatnot.
Right.
And so there's not going to be as much monkeying around, that's a technical word,
mm-hmm.
with the cars as before. And so they're being, and I don't got any problem with it.
And the best part, like, I actually think NASCAR did a pretty good job of coming up with a plan, making sure that it was acceptable, getting the right approval. I think if you're going to restart something, I think this is kind of how it would look.
Jeffrey, you don't have a gambling problem. You have a competition problem.
Believe it or not.
100%. I mean.
Wasn't it good to learn that you've got a Michael Jordan, we learned last mm-hmm. night. It's a gambling issue. It's a
the big thing we learned is that he's never had to sell his championship rings.
Right.
You know.
Yeah,
his wife hadn't left him.
Right.
You know, he's still got plenty of money. That's not a problem.
Right. As long as he's right.
Exactly.
So, let me ask you this.
Uh-huh.
So the idea is that Michael Jordan bets on things because he has this fierce need to be competitive. Right?
Yes.
Okay. I don't have the gambling gene.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of gambling repulses me. Right?
Yeah.
I already feel enough tension watching a game that I don't need extra juice or tension. I don't like the feeling of juice
mm-hmm.
and tension. I also am not competitive in the sense that I don't seek out competition.
Sure.
If I'm playing, well, back when I used to play tennis,
yeah.
I'd rather just hit the ball back across the net with someone
yeah.
than actually say, all right, let's play.
Right.
I don't like the added let's determine which of one of us is better. I shrink from it. Mm-hmm. I don't like it at all.
Yeah.
I don't like being the winner.
Mm-hmm.
I really don't like being a loser. And then I don't like being a winner because then I have to feel bad for the person. Like, I don't, whatever. I don't. Are those things always good? The gambling gene and the competitive gene, are they really related, or can you be a gambler and not have the competitive gene? How closely related, the gambling gene and the competitive gene, are those things? It seems to me they're a little different.
I know a lot of people that are uber competitive, and I would not consider them gamblers. I would also say that they have not been exposed. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I do think a lot of those people, if you would get them to start gambling, they would start to find, to me, it's a matter of, are there other ways for people to find competition and to always look for something to compete? Jordan is an example of, it doesn't matter. It's not just he is competitive. It's that he can't, like, function without competition.
It's funny. I just cannot relate to that.
Yes.
At all. Like, I shrink.
Yeah.
I like shrink a from competition.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like playing board games.
Yeah.
I don't like, that's what you hear in every cliche story about an athlete. He was competitive. This person wants to win at everything.
Yeah.
They'll want to tear your heart out in checkers.
Yeah.
I hate it.
He hates to lose more than he loves to win.
But he also, like, thrives on that, wanting to beat someone.
Yes.
I don't have that.
I would also argue part of Jordan's brilliance is, I can't think of anyone who was better trained for the pressure of the moment than Jordan, because basically everything he does is he puts stakes on everything.
Well, and he's again not the only athlete who's done this.
Sure.
He makes everything personal.
Exactly.
Right? The Tony, when they took apart Tony Kukoc,
yep,
it was because they
Tony
turned
wouldn't
him
come
into
play,
Jerry Krause. No,
yes.
It's kind of in the, yeah, he was Jerry Krause's guy,
yep,
whatever. When they played Clyde Drexler,
yep,
it was because people dared to say that Drexler
was
Jordan
on his
was
level.
On the same level. And so he tore his apart. Well, Dan Marley was seen as a Michael Jordan stopper.
Yeah.
So he has to tear him apart. He finds reasons to hate people. I'll be honest. I try to find reasons to like people. Like, that maybe, like, I understand this intellectually.
Sure.
I just don't have any of this. Like, none of it.
And I think
possibly why I'm doing a talk radio show instead of being a fiercely competitive, one of the great athletes of our time. The athleticism missing.
Yes. I mean, I think being 6'6 and an absolute freak probably helped.
Helped.
I think that helped to an extent. But I do think there's a link between someone like Michael Jordan, people that have this singular focus, and these people that are able to turn everything into motivation so that they can be great at this one thing. And I do think that you watch Jordan on this, and I mean, he's kind of a jerk.
Oh, he's a little bit of a jerk. I don't dislike him as much as I thought, but do you think, by the way, Isaiah got a raw deal, or he got a justifiable deal? You reap what you sow. Or you, because what's very clear is that when Rod Thorne has said Jordan had nothing to do with Isaiah not being on the Dream Team.
Yeah.
Total BS.
Right.
But I was listening, I don't know who it was today, talking about it. What's his name? The shooter. Tim.
Yes.
He's a talker.
Legler.
Now. Yeah, Tim Legler. And he was saying it was just understood that Jordan didn't want him on the team. You don't have to say.
Right. Never had to be said. It never had to be said.
But it wasn't just Jordan. It was
Bird.
Magic and Bird, and everybody hated Isaiah Thomas. And I guess at some level, if you've done whatever you've done, and it wasn't just because they were good, because Larry Bird was good, and Magic and Jordan didn't hate each other.
Right.
Jordan's good. Like, those guys didn't hate each other. I presume Isaiah was enough of a punk that he did stuff to be hated. If he's universally hated, I guess you reap what you sow.
I think there's an element of that. I also think that the what made this situation so interesting is you look at Isaiah and the Pistons. So first, they're the up-and-comer, underdog that's nipping at the Celtics. And so then he's going to get under Bird's skin. Well, then the Pistons do the same thing to the Lakers, and they win two championships. And then it's the Pistons have been Jordan's nemesis forever. So basically, it's like they were the Pistons and Isaiah were the biggest nemesis to each of those guys in a certain way, and that is just going to fuel. So it's like 3-on-4. Then it becomes Bird, Magic, and Michael ganging up on Isaiah, and all of them just hate him. And so, like, I think there was an element of the fact that the Pistons were kind of, you know, were thorns in the sides of each of those guys' teams.
Yeah, I think that might be. That might be it. That might be it, too. Okay, last one. Is this true? Don Shula died.
Believe it or not.
That's not even a believe it or not. I just saw the news. Don Shula has passed away.
Yes, at the age of 90 years old, he has indeed passed away today.
Well, what are you supposed to do? Have a bottle of champagne? He made it to the end.
17-0, yeah.
17-0. No one, like, he's made it to the end.
And,
And no one better than the perfect Dolphins, right?
Right.
And in the end, that's what they wanted.
I guess you could make the argument, technically the Patriots were 18-0.
When were the Patriots?
18-0, but they lost to the Giants.
No, but they lost to the Giants. Yeah, right. No. You can't make the argument if you don't win a title. Just like when the
14-game season
like
doesn't
the,
a big
just like is the Warriors. A big, then, yeah, you can't make it. No. You got to win. You got to finish it off by winning a championship. Who came closest? Those Patriots.
They were a possession away, or they're a helmet catch away. A helmet catch and a Plexico reverse.
That is so wonderful, by the way. That is so great. I covered Don Shula. Back when I was in Miami, I covered Don Shula towards the end of his tenure there. Obviously, iconic coach who, very different type of team. But, you know, Bob Greasy's in the Hall of Fame. Is he in the Hall of Fame? Is he in the Hall of Fame? Is Bob Greasy in the Hall of Fame? I bet he is.
I swear I think I picture him in the gold jacket, but I'm double checking.
I think I could picture him in the gold jacket. But, like, I don't know what his – look at Bob Greasy's best year, total yards thrown. I bet 12 quarterbacks. I bet Josh Allen threw more yards than Bob Greasy this past year. Bob Greasy's. But they have a great team. It was Kick. It was Zonka. It was Paul
Warfield.
He was Warfield.
In the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1990.
And now look at his stats. Like, they just didn't. They had the no name defense, which would pulverize you. Nick Bonacani, of course, big part of that. Defense, Manny Fernandez. They had Dick Anderson, safety. They were unbelievably sound team. Gary Premium, of course, the kicker. And then they would bludgeon you with Kick and Warfield. Kick and Zonka, and then Paul Warfield would go deep. But Paul Warfield's another guy, Hall of Fame wide receiver. His numbers compared to the receivers that you use, it's why it's so hard to pick Hall of Fame receivers now, because the numbers are so inflated relative to what they once were. Anyway, one of the great Hall of Fame coaches.
Highest, you want to guess, the single season highest passing yardage total for Bob Greasy.
14 game seasons. He never averaged 300 yards, I'm sure. So let's just say he averaged 250. So 3,200 yards.
The most Bob Greasy ever threw for in a year was 2,473. His highest per season, like season total yards per game, was 190.2.
That's unbelievable.
21 touchdowns, 16 interceptions.
21 and 16?
Yes.
And there's your Hall of Fame quarterback.
Yeah. Completed 52% of his passes.
Man, that's his best year? That's his year with the most yards. What was his best touchdown to interception ratio?
So
do you have that in front of you?
Statistically, what Football Reference would say was his best season was 1977. He completed 58.6% of his passes for 2,252 yards, 22 touchdowns, 13 interceptions. That was 7.3 yards per attempt.
Guys know Andy Dalton.
The Jason and John Show.
George Sedano does it all for ESPN. You can catch him on the sidelines, catch him on the jump around the horn, Sports Center. He's on Twitter at Sedano, and he joins us now. George, what's going on, man? Appreciate the time.
Hey, guys, how are you? I'm good, man. Just managing just like everyone else.
No question about it. So a lot to get to. Let's start, though, with the news there in Miami, which is and this is the first I've sort of seen from an NFL team or any team, really. They have this mock-up, the Dolphins do, that they've put out about a way that they can get fans in the arena and also, you know, keep that quote unquote social distance. What do you make of that? I mean, I honestly was under the assumption that we were chalking up fans for certainly 2020. What did you make of that? Is that something that you believe can work?
Man, listen, I'm not a medical professional, but all the medical professionals that I've been able to talk to or watch on TV or read, they've all said that, much like you, that having fans, at least right now, is a bad idea because the expectation is we're going to get a second wave of this thing in the fall and the winter, which would coincide with football. So I do think that laying out those plans makes some sense. I just don't know if they're going to be able to implement those plans this particular season. I mean, look, guys, this, who knows how long this thing is going to last. I'm hopeful, like everyone else, that ingenuity, health, the health department, and of course the medical community and science can help us through this as quickly as possible. But I think that we have to hope for the best, but kind of almost brace ourselves for the worst.
Mm. I had some sad news out of Miami as well about the great Don Shula, who we've lost. Rest in peace. How much did he mean to Miami pro sports? Just two losing seasons in 33, if I'm right, George. That's I don't think we'll ever see it again, right?
No, man. It's pretty incredible the run he had there. You're talking about a guy who spent 40 years in the National Football League when you couple his time as a player and as an assistant, and then, of course, as a head coach, the all-time winningest coach. And look, I'm a kid who grew up in Miami, so for me, he was all I knew. Mm-hmm. I mean, he literally put professional sports on the map in Miami. He took over a team in 1970 that had only been around for four seasons at that point and took them to a Super Bowl very quickly and then ended up winning back-to-back Super Bowls. They went to three straight Super Bowls. I mean, it was impressive. And not only that, but just the adaptability. Think about how ahead of his time he was when they picked Dan Marino in 1984, right? The 83 draft or whatever. Yeah. And then, you know, he starts Marino after the first four games. Dan plays great. He wins Rookie of the Year. But then in 84, Marino has this incredible record-setting season that took, what, 20, almost 30 years to break? You know what I mean? Like, think about that. Like, the type of passing numbers Marino was putting up in 84 with Don Shula, a guy who was known for, you know, a running game, basically. Like Bob Greasy, when they won one of those Super Bowls, threw nine passes. They ran the ball like 40, 50 times. And yet he also brought in Dan Marino, drafted Dan Marino, who broke all the records, 48 touchdowns, over 5,000 yards. And that stuff sounds like, guys throw for 5,000 a ton now anyway, or, you know, at least close to it. But think about that. Back then, defenses were mugging wide receivers. Mm-hmm. There was nothing to protect quarterbacks. I mean, what Don was able to do as he evolved with the game, and as I mentioned, kind of being ahead of his time with the passing game, was just incredible. And it goes to show you why he has reached icon status.
Do you think Tua is the face and that he'll be a great quarterback down in Miami for a decade? What do you think?
I mean, if he can stay healthy, right, that's always the big million-dollar question with him, or in this particular case, several million-dollar question. But, if you talk to people who watched him play regularly, they feel like he's a special player. And I think that if they can keep him upright, and if I were them, and again, we don't know what's going to happen with these sports in the fall. My assumption is they're going to try to start football, and I think for all our sanity, we hope that they can pull that off in a safe fashion. And I think that if that happens, I would redshirt him anyway. I mean, he may end up getting redshirted regardless, but if there was an actual season this season, I wouldn't play him. I would just sit him. I'd do kind of like what the Sixers did with Joel Embiid and just not even play him one snap, because all I want is his body to get right and make sure he has enough time to do that. You can talk about wanting him to compete all you want, but give him time to rest, give his body time to heal correctly, and smart, then unleash him at that point.
Yep.
Obviously, we're all sort of tuned in to The Last Dance. It has been good because it does give us sort of that communal thing, right? That one thing that we're all, you know, it would have been playoffs at this juncture, right? We would have been watching the NBA playoffs. We don't have that right now, but we do have this Last Dance documentary. To you, George, what's been the best part so far of this series?
I think the last couple of episodes were fantastic and have been my favorite ones. And look, they've all been great. As you pointed out, I think it's communal. I also think it kind of lets some of us old heads, I mean, I'm 42 years old, kind of relive those days, right? And it's also educational for younger people who never got a chance to watch him play. But clearly they wear his shoes and his gear, and they now truly understand why he was so special. And look, I think that the fact that it's not sanitized, I mean, we sat there yesterday and watched him talk about his gambling issues and all the stuff that he was dealing with at that particular time, that could have very easily have been scrubbed because he's controlling this particular project. He's had the ability to control this project for 20-something years, and he's finally letting it out, and he's giving us the version that is accurate. It's an accurate portrayal of what he was dealing with at that particular time. And it wasn't just that, right? Like, it wasn't just the gambling stuff. It's the stuff about Republicans buy shoes, too, the famous quote, right? I mean, he got into that, which I was surprised that he got into that, because it's something that's almost been taboo around him for a very, very long time. You know what I mean? So the fact that they dove into those particular aspects, regardless of how you feel about them, I thought was pretty fascinating.
You know, the part I was prepared, I'm 43, George, so I'm right with you in terms of there's what I thought I knew about it, right? I was a Bulls fan, so I thought I knew everything. And then there's what I'm seeing. And I was prepared to watch him bully around the Steve Kerrs and Bushlers and Will Perdue's. But to see the way he did Scotty, right, that like the stop in the interview, he's been even in some instances, and I realized Scotty at that point was, you know, maybe even the second best player in the league, but like controlling him and no, you're not going to do this interview and I'm going to push the horn on the bus because I want to go golf. Like, I wasn't prepared for that, George. Were you already, did you know that was coming?
I didn't know that particular story, but I knew that he was in control. He was the man that pulled the strings there in Chicago. For as much as Jerry Krause wanted to be that guy, that's who he was. And I thought the other interesting part of it was clearly we've always assumed Kobe wanted to emulate Michael,
right?
And Michael kind of explained that to us, their relationship at Kobe's memorial, may he rest in peace. But to see Kobe Bryant on there at the beginning of this documentary, I felt like, or yesterday's episodes at least, I felt like was just surreal to kind of watch him. It almost, the emotions were kind of, you know, were getting to me a little bit. I'm like, man, this is just wild that he's not here to talk about this, but yet we're seeing him because it's still so new. You know what I mean? Like, it's only been 3 months, and it feels like at times it was yesterday. And it also feels weird to me still talking about Kobe in the past tense. So there were a lot of things going on in yesterday's two episodes, as fast paced as they were, that I thought were just really, really interesting.
Yeah, we are, of course, talking to George Dino. Catch him all over ESPN, around the horn, on the sidelines, when NBA games do return, and SportsCenter. In terms of the NBA, obviously, we're all sort of speculating here, but it's hard to imagine, right, George, a full postseason at this point. Like, I'm throwing out a regular season because there's really no value in bringing all 30 teams back to play when the overwhelming majority of them are out of contention anyway. And so now you're focused on what a postseason would look like. Well, that can usually take 2 months, right? And it's hard to see, you know, 16 NBA teams being willing to just essentially isolate and quarantine themselves for 2 months. What do you think if it comes back, and I think most people think it might, what would it look like?
So I think that as much as I'm with you, I think, you know, I would just go straight to the playoffs, cut the amount of teams. That way you have less of a possibility of spreading if someone catches the virus. I don't know how feasible that's going to be because I don't know if the owners are going to be interested in writing a check back to the regional sports networks. Because now I don't know how this works. Because previously, I know that there have been lockout seasons or strike-shortened seasons where they didn't play 70 games, but my understanding is for the teams to get the full boat on their RSN money, they would have to play 70 games. So there is the possibility that if that were the magic number, that these teams may have to play regular season games, maybe not what was scheduled, but play them in pods. For example, each individual division would play amongst each other to finish out the requisite amount of games. Now, it's strange because some teams have played 65 or 66 games. Some teams have played 63 games. It kind of varies somewhere between 63 and 67 based on the team. So it would be weird, but I think that that is at least on the table. And then as far as the postseason is concerned, I do think that if they get there, and I'm still an optimist when it comes to the NBA, the NHL, and even Major League Baseball, because I think that we'll hit a stretch here where I think that we will have the virus, maybe not under control, but at least to a point where we could do this without fans, right? And I think the medical experts have all said that. And because of that, I do think that you're going to get kind of the bubble city situation, whether that's Disney World in Orlando or Vegas or whatever. I personally think Disney World in Vegas, and I know before people start saying that I'm a company shill because ESPN is owned by Disney, here's my reasoning for that. It's pretty simple. If you just do the postseason in Disney World, it's a 39-mile radius of land, okay, that has an entrance and an exit that can clearly be shut off from the rest of the world. The other part of it is this. It's got 25 resorts within those 39 miles. So each team could have their own resort, and they're all fairly close to each other. There are several courts there. The NBA does their NBA Junior Jam games there, these AAU-type games. They have the Disney Wide World of Sports. There's a lot of possibilities there where there are already courts. If not, courts can be built to play a lot of games simultaneously. So I do think that you have the ability to make that happen at a place like that and keep everyone insulated and safe.
Can we get the Grizzlies and Ja Morant in there, George? Can we get them in your postseason plan?
Yeah, they're in. Like, right. Okay. Listen, if it were up to me, I told you, I'd cut out everyone who's not in the postseason already, so they'd be in.
Of course.
Hey, George, man, we appreciate the time.
Thanks,
as
brother.
Always. Be safe, man. Thank you.
You got it, guys. You too. Take care.
Yep. He is George Sedano.
Don't miss the Jason and John Show tomorrow at 11 a.m. on 92.9 FM ESPN.